From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonida Inge.
And I'm Jeff Tiberi. According to a Pew Research study released late last year, a majority of Americans report that they are being asked to tip more often than they were 5 years ago. And when it comes to restaurant tipping, our topic today, people have a lot to say about it online.
If you cannot afford to tip your server, please stop going out to eat.
If you cannot afford to tip 20%, you can't afford to eat out.
They gave me $30.20 on a $29.15 check.
You can moan and tell me that my employer should be paying me a higher wage all you want, but this is America and that's not what is happening, okay?
I can't be tipping y'all 20% anymore. I can't, because you guys don't deserve it. Like, I'm just gonna be honest. I'm a server. And a lot of you servers, you don't deserve 20%. I'm sorry.
It seems we may be at a crossroads when it comes to tipping in the food service industry in the U.S. Later in the show, we're going to talk with a restaurant owner who decided to go tip-free.
First, we're going to get deep into the history of tipping here on Due South, which, unsurprisingly, is rooted in racism, and how that history plays out today for workers. Joining us for the conversation is Saru Jayaraman. Saru is the president of One Fair Wage, an organization advocating for a full and fair minimum wage for all workers, including the millions of restaurant workers who are paid a sub-minimum wage.
She's also the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-founder of the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United.
Saru, welcome to Due South.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to chat about history of tipping here in a bit, but first, I want to ask you about how tipping plays out in your own life, if we can get a little bit personal with you. This is something that I think about regularly. I go out with my wife and my kids. None of us in this conversation get compensated by tips, but we do all interact with the tipping economy on a regular basis, and I'm curious, what's your tipping philosophy?
So, in part because I've been doing this work for 22 years, I know deeply the history and the problems with the system. So every time I eat out at the end of my meal, I, of course, tip 20% in restaurants, and I communicate to the employers, not the server, but the manager or owner at the end of my meal. I really appreciated the food and the service. And if I'm not in California, I'm in a place like North Carolina or somewhere else, I say, I would love to see you pay these workers an actual full minimum wage and let my tip be on top of that wage, not instead of my wage. Outside of restaurants, I don't tip 20% because I don't want to encourage other industries to start emulating the restaurant industry in using tips to supplement or to replace wages. And we are seeing a dangerous trend in that direction.
We will keep this conversation, I think, positive. But I do want to ask, what about when you have a bad experience of you get the wrong plate, somebody doesn't come to check on you, whatever it may be. But, you know, we have a standard of good service at a restaurant, and I personally generally get it all the time. But what about when it goes the other way? How do you handle that situation as it pertains to tipping?
Me personally, I tip 20% in all circumstances in a restaurant because restaurant workers rely on those tips to get closer to a wage that is actually anywhere near the cost of living currently anywhere in the United States.
So let's dive into the history a little bit. You know, the U.S. has its own specific tipping history. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah. So prior to emancipation, waiters in the U.S. were mostly white men. They worked in cities like Boston and Philadelphia and New York, and they got an actual wage. Tipping was not prevalent at the time. In fact, it was pretty reviled at the time. It was mostly in Europe as an extra or bonus on top of a wage that a lord or an aristocrat or a duke gave to their servants, but always on top of a wage. When the idea came to the States, as I said, first it was rejected, but when those white male waiters went on strike in 1853, the restaurant industry started looking for cheaper labor, and after emancipation, they found it. They started hiring newly freed Black women in particular, telling them, we're not going to pay you at all, you're going to live on this new thing that's just come from Europe called a tip. And that was made law in 1938, and it was the first time in world history that tipping was mutated from being an extra bonus on top of a wage, as it had always been for generations, to becoming a replacement for wages as a way to allow the hospitality sector to have free Black female labor. And here we are in 2024. The federal minimum wage for tipped workers is still $2.13 an hour for a population still to this day that is overwhelmingly women, disproportionately women of color, who struggle with the highest rates of both poverty and sexual harassment of any industry in the U.S. because they have to put up with so much from customers to get tips to make a portion of their base wage, not as an extra or a bonus on top of their wage.
Saru Jayaraman is here with us on Due South talking about the history of tipping. I want to hang on to that historical nugget for a moment. We're talking about the 19th century and emancipation, and you note that this is not some cultural thing that was taken from Imperial Britain. Who did come up with this idea to implement this here? Was it political? Was it like, what are the origins of that?
Yeah, completely political, and it really comes from Chicago, where there were two industries that sought to do this initially. One was called the Pullman Train Company. It was a luxury train that was running from the East Coast to the West Coast.
With a lot of Black Pullman porters.
They started hiring tens of thousands of Black men, calling them all George, and telling them, we're going to not pay you. You're going to live on this new thing called a tip. And the restaurant industry in Chicago observed what was happening with the Pullman trains and emulated that, but with Black women. So the Pullman car porters fought and won an actual wage, what we call one fair wage, in 1937. But 1938, the Restaurant Association, the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA, which was formed basically in response to the Pullman car porters organizing, they wanted to make sure that the waitresses never got what the porters got. And so they formed the other NRA and won the exemption of tipped restaurant workers in 1938 from the New Deal, the year just after Pullman car porters won it for themselves. So we're fighting 100 years later for women to get what the Pullman car porters won in 1937.
At the risk of being reductive or oversimplifying, will you take us through, give us the Cliff Notes version of the rest of the 20th century post-New Deal, what brings us, you know, 80-plus years later to today?
80-plus years later, you've got a trade lobby that still is around since 1919, the National Restaurant Association, that has fought to maintain the sub-minimum wage, and it exists today in both federal law and in 43 states. There are 7 states that got rid of this many decades ago. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska all require a full minimum wage with tips on top, but 43 states persist with a sub-minimum wage. But it is changing. Look, with the pandemic, millions of workers walked off the job refusing to work for these wages. We've seen thousands of restaurants across the country, in the South, everywhere, raise wages to recruit staff. And in response, we're winning. We're finally winning pretty massive wage increases. We just won a wage increase in D.C., Chicago, Flagstaff, Arizona. This year, there's legislation and ballot measures moving in 13 states. So there's tremendous momentum for change right now with the rising cost of living and post-pandemic, when workers are saying, I can't live on tips anymore, especially because we're seeing tips go down economy-wide.
So when you think of the sub-minimum wage for food service workers, you know, really, I'd like to know, what has that done to worker pay? It seems to have squashed it in many ways. But then also think about, you know, when workers, you know, when they don't make a minimum wage, are their employers, what are their employers actually doing to pay them? Are they doing anything different that hopefully there is hope in coming years when it comes to our food service workers?
Yeah. So we were just chatting about 1991 when the internet was created, and it was long before many of your listeners were born. 1991 was the last time this minimum wage for tipped workers went up. 1991, the wage went up from a little over a dollar to $2.13 an hour. So these workers have not received a wage in more than 40 years.
A wage increase.
And you're talking about two generations of women now in our membership, mothers and daughters, who have lived through their entire lives working at $2.13 an hour. There is federal law that says employers are supposed to ensure that tips bring you to the full minimum wage, or they're supposed to make up the difference. But under the Obama administration, the U.S. Department of Labor did an investigation into this, and they found an 84% violation rate with regard to restaurants actually following those rules that they have to make up the difference if tips don't bring you to the full minimum wage. And so as a result of that, you've got the largest industry of women. That's also the lowest wage industry in America. That is an industry in which tipped workers suffer from 3 times the poverty rate of other workers and use food stamps at double the rate. But you're right. There is hope on the way because so many women said enough is enough during the pandemic. So many of these women didn't get unemployment insurance when everybody else, when the entire economy was shut down with COVID. 2/3 of these workers told us they couldn't get unemployment insurance because they were told their wages were too low to qualify for benefits. And then they went back to work. They said tips had gone way down, harassment way up. They were asked to enforce COVID protocols on the same people from whom they had to get tips, and they were done. They started leaving. And we are seeing thousands of restaurants across the country raising wages to recruit and retain staff because so few people want to come back to an industry where your income goes up and down day to day, week to week, month to month, shift to shift, season to season. Your bills and your rent don't go up and down. They just keep going up. Your tips go up and down all the time.
We're going to hit pause for just a moment, take a break, come back, continue our conversation with Saru Jeyaraman, president and co-founder of One Fair Wage, also director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. You're listening to Due South on listener-supported North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Welcome back. It's Due South on WUNC, along with Leonida Inge. I'm Jeff Tiberi, chatting with Saru Jeyaraman, president and co-founder of One Fair Wage. We're talking about the history of tipping. One quick follow-up here, Saru. You mentioned that 84% of restaurants, I believe that's a figure you mentioned a moment ago, were out of compliance and were not helping waiters and waitresses get to the designated benchmark. Is there any kind of enforcement to this for establishments that are not helping their employees get to where they were supposed to be getting? Has there ever been an enforcement mechanism?
The U.S. Department of Labor is assigned. That is their role, is to accept complaints from workers and then go out and enforce the law, force employers to make sure they're ensuring that tips bring workers to the full minimum wage and making up the difference. But there's so many problems with this system that the Solicitor General, Patricia Smith, of the U.S. Department of Labor in 2014, when they did that investigation, declared the issue unenforceable. She said, first of all, it's impossible for a worker to know, did my tips every hour bring me to the full minimum wage? When they get their paycheck, it's very hard to determine hour by hour, did tips bring me to the full minimum wage? Second of all, it's hard for small business employers in particular to keep track of hour by hour. And third of all, it's truly impossible for any government agency to know whether every employer is ensuring for every hour every tipped worker works, does the tip bring them to the full minimum wage, or are they paying the difference? It is, she said, unenforceable. And that is the moment at which the Obama administration actually changed their stance from supporting a subminimum wage to actually being in favor of ending a total subminimum wage, ending the subminimum wage for tipped workers altogether. And that is why President Biden, who was vice president at the time, actually just issued an executive order a few years ago for federally contracted employees ending all subminimum wages for tipped workers among federally subcontracted employees. That is actually the law that was included in the Raise the Wage Act that passed the House in 2019 and again in 2021. So there is a lot of momentum for change. And it is largely because after years of the Restaurant Association arguing what you just said, can't we just enforce the existing law? The U.S. Department of Labor saying, no, actually we can't. It's unenforceable. This system doesn't work. We need to just follow California and the 7 states that got rid of this and pay everybody a minimum wage with tips on top. Because after all, that is what most of us, when we eat out, we started this conversation with you asking me about my tipping practices and sharing your tipping practices. I am sure when most of us eat out, we do not expect our tips to be used by the employer to pay the base wage of the worker. We think of our tips as an extra or a bonus on top of a wage for a job well done. Mm. And that is how they were created and intended to be from centuries ago.
We have so many questions to ask you, Saru, but does it matter if you tip, say if you're using a credit card or a debit card and you just add the tip on the card, or should you put cash down or put cash in the jar?
So the overwhelming majority of states allow restaurants to deduct credit card processing fees from workers' tips, which can be a significant amount of money that comes out of the tip you're leaving the worker when you do that on a credit card. Also, what happens with the credit card is that it all gets lumped together with the pay. And again, it's very difficult for a worker to know how much of this came on Tuesday at 3 o'clock. For those reasons, cash is preferable. I know, and even for me in this day and age, it's very difficult to carry around cash. So that is why we say if you can't carry around cash, make sure you are communicating at the end of your meal with the manager or the owner, the employer, that you like to eat there and the service is excellent, but you want to see your tip be on top of a wage, not instead of a wage.
You know, when I was a young reporter, I was given a card that I could just plop down that said, the law says this meeting should be open and I deserve to be here. So I think you need to come up with these cards and ship them around so customers can just say, here. And that card says, I want to make sure this worker's tip is da-da-da-da-da. So I just gave you something to do.
We did that at one point with a bunch of churches. But as we talked about earlier, we're all older and we like the cards. Young people want to be able to do things on their phone.
I know. Well, maybe you should put give you something harder to do then. You know, develop an app that people can download and it can speak for them.
That's right. Yes, we are working on that.
Saru Jayaraman is president and co-founder of One Fair Wage, also director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Would love for you to tell us a little bit more about the American South and what sub-minimum wage pay looks like in the South and or what is noteworthy about the South and this conversation.
Unfortunately, most of the South is exactly at that federal subminimum wage for tipped workers of $2.13 an hour. That is the wage for almost all Southern states except Florida, where voters, even in a very red state, more voters voted in 2020 to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour and the subminimum wage to $13.50. And more voters voted for that than Trump or Biden in 2020 on the ballot, which just shows you, even in the South, this is an incredibly popular, overwhelmingly popular issue with people of all backgrounds, political leanings, ages, races, genders. Most people in America and in the South agree that when you work, you should be paid by your employer. And the tips you give from our hard-earned, income should be on top of that minimum wage from your employer, not instead of it. So most of the South still remains at $2, but we hope to put this issue on the ballot in many Southern states, just like was done in Florida, so that these workers can get a full minimum wage with tips on top. We also keep fighting for federal minimum wage that would end the subminimum wage for tipped workers so that all of the South, whether that you're allowed to put it on the ballot or not, can benefit from an increase.
In this area, I've been to many rallies for Fight for 15, the red T-shirts, the banners, just marching up and down the street. And hopefully that's making some traction. I actually haven't seen a lot of protests post-COVID, to tell you the truth, but maybe they're still coming together and formalizing their team.
Well, post-COVID, what the hopeful part, even in the South, is that post-COVID, people protested with their feet.
Right.
I mean,
they left.
Workers left this industry.
They quit. And
even in the South, we have seen restaurants having to raise wages to recruit staff. We are seeing Applebee's in Alabama paying $15 an hour plus tips because they can't get enough people to come back any other way. Now, let me be clear. There is a National Restaurant Association. They represent the chains. And their solution to the staffing crisis, they're moving bills and ballot measures in many Southern states and other states to weaken child labor laws. Their goal is to allow 13-year-olds to serve alcohol in bars. And that is not a solution for an industry that has the highest rates of sexual harassment and sexual assault of any industry, because women of all ages have to put up with so much to get tips from customers. So allowing a 13-year-old girl to serve alcohol in a bar with inebriated men is just a disaster already. I don't know, I was going to say disaster in waiting, but it's a disaster, period. And so that kind of a solution is the wrong solution when so many independent restaurants in the South are raising wages to recruit staff. In every state in the South, we have amazing restaurant owners, independent restaurant owners who have voluntarily raised wages to recruit staff.
You know, a few weeks ago, we spoke with Jen Hampton. She's an organizer for Asheville Food and Beverage United, and she worked as a server for decades. And she said a lot of really interesting things happened, but here's something that stuck out, you know, for me about what it's like to be a server.
You have to put on this performance. You have to put up with whatever the customer says to you, especially when it's unwanted, you know, sexual harassment sort of things, that you just have to smile and take it, because if you don't, you won't get a tip and you're not getting paid.
So when you mentioned the younger workers there, I just wondered if that's your view, that tipping can actually promote, like you said, sexual harassment on the job.
It's not my view. There's irrefutable data now that unfortunately our industry has the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry. And that's because when you force a woman to actually rely on tips as the majority or all of her income. Look, when your wage is $2.13, that wage goes entirely to taxes. You're living completely off your tips. You have to put up with whatever the customer does to you, however they touch you or treat you or talk to you, because the customer is paying your bills, not your employer. And we know that in the 7 states that require employers to pay a full minimum wage with tips on top, sexual harassment is cut in half. We have half the sexual harassment rate in the restaurant industry in California, as you do in North Carolina. Why? Because we require employers to guarantee workers that minimum wage, no matter what, so that they can say to a customer, buzz off, I don't need you. I don't need your tip. I get tips. In fact, they get more tips, but I don't need your tip. I don't need to put up with the harassment to get your tip, because I can count on a wage from my boss, like every other worker in every other industry.
You know, Jeff, did you hear Saru say a couple of times now, kind of comparing the National Restaurant Association to the NRA?
I've heard this NRA connection. You've referred to the National Restaurant Association, which, as you note, is a big restaurant industry trade group representing hundreds of thousands of food service establishments, as the other NRA. Unpack that, please. Why do you call the National Restaurant Association the other National Rifle Association, NRA?
Well, it's because so many people know the National Rifle Association. So many people are aware of what they've done in terms of the kind of outsized influence that they have over electeds, the amount of money gun manufacturers have put into essentially bribing legislators to stop gun reform, even when the majority of Americans agree with it. And so we want people to know there's another trade lobby that behaves exactly the same. The National Restaurant Association is the other NRA. They've been around since 1919. Their origins are trying to maintain a subminimum or non-wage for Black women. That's who they are. That's where they come from. And they've been around for more than 100 years fighting to maintain a subminimum wage for tipped workers because of greed. Let's be real. That's what this is about. These are chain restaurants that basically are profiting while paying a full minimum wage in California and Oregon and Washington. So they know it can work, but they don't want to have to pay it in the South. They don't want to have to pay it everywhere in the country. And so they fight it, even though they know they can be successful while paying a full minimum wage. And they love to spread misinformation, just like the Rifle Association. They love to tell people, you know, the entire industry is going to collapse if we have to pay a full minimum wage. Tipping will go away. Jobs will be lost. Even while those same chains are paying a full minimum wage in California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska, and growing faster in California than any other state. So they know the truth, and they purposefully spread misinformation and lies. That's why we compare them.
We want to be mindful and respectful of your time. You need to go here in a second, but hopefully we can squeeze in one more, which is there are some service workers who do not want a minimum wage. They are okay, evidently, and maybe I'm being reductive with the word okay, but they're okay with things as they are.
They get good tips.
Yeah. What do you say to them?
And fine restaurants.
So they unfortunately have been sold a bunch of lies, as I just said, by the Restaurant Association, because the question is not, we're not proposing getting rid of tips. As I just mentioned, the seven states that already do this have higher, much higher tipping averages than North Carolina and the 43 states with tips on top. And so what we are fighting for is a full minimum wage with tips on top, better wages, better tips. And if these workers were asked the correct question, the question is not, do you want a minimum wage or tips? The question is, do you want a full minimum wage with tips on top? There is no worker who would say no to that. There is no worker who would say, no, I don't want a minimum wage and all my tips. And that is what workers already have in seven states where the industry is flourishing.
So what's on the horizon when it comes to restaurant worker pay in 2024, this big election year?
I want everybody to know that the top issues in multiple voter polls in 2024 among young people and people of color are the rising cost of living and jobs with living wages. You know, I think it would surprise a lot of people to know that it's not any number of issues that the two parties seem to spend all their time talking about. It's actually just this. People cannot afford to live anywhere in the country right now. The cost of living has exceeded all wages for low-wage workers. And so unless candidates and electeds focus on this issue and address it, you're going to have a lot of people who sit this year out because they're not hearing anybody talk about the thing that is top of mind for them, which is their ability to feed their children, pay their bills, pay the gas, and survive.
Saru Jayaraman is president and co-founder of One Fair Wage, as well as director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you for the expertise and the passion that you brought here on Due South.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for that card I want. I'm old school. I want the card in my hand.
Okay, I'll get you the card.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good to see you. Take care.
Due South reached out to the National Restaurant Association for comment. Here's what they had to say. Quote, "There's a reason people choose tipped restaurant jobs. They know the economics are in their favor. For many servers, they've chosen restaurant careers because their industry skills and knowledge mean high earning potential in a job that's flexible to their needs. For others, they're looking for something. Extra income, customer interaction, business skills that make the opportunity ideal. The current system of tipping means that the industry can fit all their needs. This is why operators and tipped employees have worked for years to preserve the mutually beneficial tip credit." That's from Sean Kennedy, Executive Vice President of Public Affairs of the National Restaurant Association. There is a diversity of opinions between restaurant workers themselves about what the best way forward is. Some servers do want to keep things the way they are.
They worry that an increase to their minimum wage would lead to restaurant surcharges and less money in tips for a lower total take-home pay.
I work at a diner. I've been working in restaurants for 20 years. Never worked with a fancy, you know, upscale restaurant with white linen tablecloths. Always been able to pay my bills.
Working in like a bar as a bartender, you know, you get the sexual harassment, you get all of that, but you can't really stand up for yourself because you know, hey, I need this tip. My employer's not paying me.
That was a clip from a D.C. area TV station, WUSA 9, featuring voices from a rally both for and against raising the tipped minimum wage in Montgomery County, Maryland. And there are different ways to get better, more consistent pay for workers. Some restaurants, including many in the Triangle, are voluntarily adding in what some call a living wage fee on top of the cost of the food. As a customer, the collision of tipping, service charges, fees, it can feel murky sometimes and not feel totally clear where the money is going. Our next guest has taken a lot of the guesswork out of restaurant worker pay by going tip-free and paying a minimum of $17 an hour. And for full-time employees, there's also holiday pay, $225 a month toward health expenses, and 3% retirement match for part and full-time employees. If you live in Durham, you might know the place I'm talking about, Monuts Donuts. The chef and owner is Lindsay Moriarty. And 3 years ago, the team at Monuts decided it was the right time to go tip-free.
Something that happened during the pandemic was consumers started to understand how much it sucked to work in the restaurant industry. I mean, maybe not for the first time, but it seemed like there was some sympathy that they started to have for the people in this industry. And so Rob and I, my husband and business partner, started to get this sense that we had a little bit more leeway to make a big decision that the consumer base would normally be more upset about, whereas now they were like, oh, those poor restaurant workers, so many of them lost their jobs, and the ones that are still working, like, let's do everything we can to keep them going. And so we decided that we were going to make Monuts a tip-free restaurant, which meant raising our menu prices by about 15%, just completely straight off the bat.
I'm assuming, you know, customers like me were like, yes, probably didn't even understand everything that was going on, but definitely your workers, your employees were like, really?
Yeah, I think we weren't sure where we were going to get the pushback, so we kind of anticipated on different fronts. I think Durham customers in general are pretty sympathetic to these sorts of causes. And so we put out a public statement explaining what we were about to do. And before we did that, we talked to each one of our employees one at a time to kind of explain why we were doing this and how it would impact them individually. And for the most part, I think everyone understood and was like, yes, let's do this.
Well, I'll be back in a moment with Lindsay Moriarty, owner and chef of Monuts, to talk more about going tip-free and what it takes to pay her employees a living wage. I'm Leonita Inge. This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge, and this is Due South on WUNC. We've been talking about tipping today and its history and how the American practice of restaurant tipping impacts worker pay. Now a conversation with a restaurant owner in Durham who's tipped over the tipping convention by going tip-free. Lindsay Moriarty is owner and chef of Monuts Donuts in Durham, a small business that offers a living wage, health insurance, and paid time off to its employees. Welcome to Due South, Lindsay.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we're going to get to your decision 3 years ago to go tip-free and how that's worked out for you and your employees. But really to understand, you know, how you got to that point, I'd like to start at the beginning of your Monuts story because it seems like it's all, you know, all related. So let's go back to 2011. Huh? What was going on in your life?
I think I had just graduated from UNC with two master's degrees, one in economic development from the School of the City Planning Department and one from public health.
I remember that because soon after, you know, I saw you on this tricycle, you know, pedaling through Durham. And I was like, how is she going to get up that hill? I just don't know, you know. But so now we're going to move on to, like, how did you get your business off the ground?
Okay, so I graduated and I was very confident and sure that I would be able to find my dream job, essentially. I drained my bank account and went to Greece for the summer, came back with no job offers and no leads whatsoever. And so it got to the point that I had to start paying bills again, even though the jobs weren't necessarily materializing. And so I was starting to look at, you know, working in restaurants or retail stores. And I had this idea to sell donuts off of a tricycle. It was a little bit of a whim and a dare and just something that we had joked about with friends for a while. And so the stars were kind of aligning in a way that I was like, maybe I could do that.
And so now you're trying to actually get an establishment of your own because the donuts on the tricycle, that kicked off right nice.
It did. We started selling donuts at the Durham Farmers Market. We set up right next to the food trucks.
And that was before there were a lot of food trucks.
It was. It was just like Pie Pushers, Monuts. I think Chirpa Chirpa was out there. Mm-hmm. And we weren't even like legally supposed to be there at the time. It was well before Hunt Street was established as like the food truck area. But folks were lining up down the street. I don't even think our donuts tasted very good at the time. I have no background in cooking, but we started selling donuts on Saturdays at the farmer's market, and I was using the cookery as this, my legal kitchen to be cooking. I was making money to cover my expenses, but not enough money to live off of necessarily.
and maybe some listeners out there think, oh, I can do that. You know, that she did it. I can do that. But even though you say you want a great cook, I mean, I remember, wasn't this like your grandmother's recipe or something?
I wish I had a story like that.
I thought you had a good, I was like, wait a minute, what, isn't it the recipe?
I don't even know where the initial recipe came from.
Goodness.
I think it was somewhere on like a corner of the internet that like has evolved over time. But just a lot of trial and error on our part, cooking in our home kitchen first and then at the cookery.
So something, I guess very good happened. You know, I'm skipping to your husband's uncle kind of gave you a business loan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so flash forward about a year or so, or maybe like 6 to 8 months, and I was deciding like, what was I actually going to do? Like, was Monut something that I wanted to take to the next level, or was I ready to pivot back into the life that I had planned for myself and start looking for jobs again?
Urban planning, yeah.
And I had, in the meantime, applied for a doctoral program in the same department that I had just graduated from, and I had heard that I was accepted and that I had a fully funded fellowship to go ahead and start in the fall. And so I had when I didn't have options in 2011, I did have options at this point. And so in my head, I was going to go back to school because that seemed like a very safe, good option. And so I continued selling donuts at the farmer's market just to kind of pass time. And we were also doing deliveries on Friday. And so I was making a delivery one Friday downtown. I was on Parrish Street. And at the time, Parrish Street Takeout was moving out of their space. And I took a picture of the like building with the moving truck out front. And I texted it to my boyfriend, Rob, as just like a, or maybe we could do this instead. And I didn't think anything was going to come of it. But I went home that night and Rob's like, well, if you wanted, you could do Monuts instead of going back to school. And I was like, I could. I'm a very risk-averse person, which I'm sure sounds odd coming from someone who started selling donuts off a tricycle. But the idea of like getting my PhD, having a job with security was really appealing to me. So doing this other wildly unresponsible, kind of life path seemed wild. But that's what I ended up deciding. And so we called the person who owned that space and asked them what they were looking for. And they said they would consider us as a tenant, but we had to pay for the upfit of the space. And since it had been occupied for a while, it was a restaurant space, which was good because it had some of the infrastructure that we would need. But it was still a space that hadn't been touched in decades. And so we talked to Jim, who is Rob's uncle, and, kind of gave him the rundown. And he said yes. Jim and Seth said yes. And they gave us, it was just $100,000. And not just, that's a ton of money.
Yeah,
it was
okay.
More than I had ever seen. But it was basically, it covered the renovation of the space so that Monuts could move from being a tricycle and this like temporary business that was something fun to do on the weekends, but not really a job that could pay me, and move it into a space where it could be an actual full-time job for me.
This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonida Inge, and I'm talking with Lindsay Moriarty, owner and chef of Monuts Donuts. You know, that's really a privilege that most people probably just don't have. So did you feel an obligation to kind of pass along that goodwill? You know, I'm just trying to get to the point when you started really thinking about your employees and making sure they had benefits.
Yeah, so when it became a very real option starting Monuts as a restaurant, I knew from the get-go that if I was going to do that, I was going to run the restaurant in a way that mirrored my values. I knew what the restaurant industry had a reputation of. My mom and dad, they were servers and cooks my whole life. I knew what that life was, and I knew that if I was going to be someone responsible for running a restaurant, I didn't want that same reputation attached to my business. And so from the get-go, we were committed to paying a living wage, offering benefits. And part of that came from just my background in economic development and my own kind of interests that had I gone back to school or found a job, I think I would have been working on something related to these things. And so being able to bring them into this business was kind of how I justified doing Monets instead of going back to school. I was like, well, I could go study this and, you know, maybe 10 years from now, I'll have something that could be applied, or I could implement it and do it myself in real time. And maybe that could have a better impact.
Well, before we talk about just the decision to become tip-free, you know, people laughed at you when you first suggested, you know, you would pay health insurance, right? You know, how did you make that work when it seems like so many in the restaurant industry would not be able to kind of make those numbers add up that way?
I mean, I think we had the benefit of we were young and naive, and we still believed that we could kind of do anything. And I say we because Rob was kind of my business partner at that time, even though he was still in school. But he was definitely my co-conspirator in all of this. I don't know. I think for us, it was the only option forward. And so even if it wasn't possible and everyone did, they were kind of like, I think when we opened, we were paying so much above what other people were paying that we were getting laughed at. And they all kind of looked at us like, oh, those kids with the college degrees think they know so much better than us, but like wait until they actually get in the kitchen and start working. They're going to have to start rolling back those benefits and hiring lower.
And how much were you paying then?
We were paying $12 an hour.
Wow.
In 2011. And I don't know, I think for us, like I said, it was the only option. So if we couldn't make it work, then we didn't want to run a restaurant. And so we were committed to it completely, and we didn't want to sacrifice what those values were from the beginning.
So tell me about, say, you know, like the front of the house workers and the back of the house workers. And, you know, how did that work in your place of business? Because I guess some folks think the people in the front make more. I don't know. But we know the people in the back work hard, work maybe harder. I don't know.
Yes.
But tell me what that meant in your place.
So we knew that there would be some tips, but we didn't have a sense of how much we were going to be bringing in from tips. And it wasn't a sit-down restaurant where there was a typical server. And so we didn't anticipate tips to be very high. So we paid, gosh, I think the front of house was making $12 an hour plus tips, and the kitchen was probably, and the kitchen was my dad, who, as I said, was a cook who had kind of like semi-retired to come up here to help me, but he still needed to get paid. And then Rob and myself. So we didn't have a huge staff to begin with. At the time, there was legislation in place that made it illegal to share tips with the back of house. Mm. And so at the time, the tips that were coming in were going just to the front of house. And so almost immediately, what we thought we were setting up as a fair system for both the front of house and the back of house to be getting paid relatively equally, it like doubled overnight because we were getting so much in tips and we weren't allowed to share it with the back of house. And we only had one person working in the front of house. So that person was really bringing in quite a bit more.
Mm, you had to even that out some kind of way.
Yeah. And we couldn't. We didn't have the money to raise the wages in the back of house. Fortunately, like we could cut our own salaries as much as we wanted. But there was definitely tension around the front of house. Like the back of house definitely knows that the front of house is making more money and they want a piece of it. And simply saying, like, I can't legally do that isn't a good enough justification for everybody back there, because I think a lot of other restaurants were doing it. And so breaking through kind of those norms and conventions of what they were used to was definitely a struggle for us.
So now we have the pandemic, and you had to do a lot more thinking and a lot more planning. And what made you just say no tips?
Yeah, so in 2021, as we were about a year into the pandemic, and that disparity in wages between front of house and back of house had persisted from when we opened in 2011, or 2012 probably, when the restaurant opened. And it just kind of came to a bubbling point where, on one hand, Rob and I were so tired and like kind of exhausted from all of the strategizing and pivoting and kind of just running ourselves ragged, trying to figure out how to make this restaurant work. We both just decided that if we were going to keep working this hard to keep Monuts running, we wanted to make sure we were staying committed to those initial principles that, you know, got us into it in the first place. And tipping and the disparity between the front of house and back of house had always been something that we wished we had we known that we were going to get so much in tips right off the bat. I think we would have started tip we would have started without tips. But once you start a restaurant with tips, it's so hard to take it away. And so we just decided we were going to rip the Band-Aid off because we had this moment in time where the consumer base was sympathetic to the plight of the restaurant workers or those that were still working in restaurants. And it was also a time where I think people who were working in the restaurant industry were fleeing. I mean, so many people got laid off.
So were you scared? Were you scared you're going to lose your business? Or
I think I was just, we were at a point where I think we knew Monuts would be okay, but we were worried that we lost the labor force. And so even though we hadn't laid anybody off and we hadn't had anybody quit, the idea that so many people had been laid off really, I think, soured the labor market for people who were still trying to hire staff members. And I was worried about that. I was worried about what would happen the next time we put an ad out. Would there still be 20 people lined up to get this job? And so we started thinking about ways to continue to differentiate ourselves and make sure that Monuts was still a good job. And so we decided to go tip-free.
So how do you feel about that now? How is it working out? How are your employees doing?
I feel great about it. It's unfortunate that in order to make that transition, some of our front of house staff members did see a pay decrease. I think that was the hardest part of it. And I'm sure even if our staff members were supportive of the decision to go tip free, it sucks that in order to make that happen, we, you know, their wages did go down a little bit. But I think 3 years forward, we've been able to recuperate almost anything that was lost. We implemented a profit sharing program. And so I think if there was a problem with the system, it would have come out by now. And I think that if the employees weren't happy with it, we would have seen more people leave. It would be hard for us to hire. And that's just not been the case. And so I'm really happy that we, you know, took that moment that we saw and made this big shift, because I think it was the only thing we could do to minimize that disparity between the front of house. And also it was a way for us to just step away from the tipping movement, which I think is a system that is broken and rooted in bias that we didn't want to really support anymore.
Mm. Do you see yourselves as a leader in this arena, especially in Durham and the Triangle? Maybe even the state.
I, at one point, had hoped that that would be the case. But I think it's hard for people to get rid of tipping. And even though I have this example and I can say, no, you can do it, people always have a way of saying, oh, it only works for you because dot, dot, dot. And I don't know. I think I've lost a little bit of my fight to convince other people to do what I'm doing just because, I don't know, self-preservation, I suppose.
Well, thank you for being here and good luck. And everybody I know wants a good Monut. I mean, in this area. So thank you very much. And for being brave, you know, you had to do something pretty brave.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Lindsay Moriarty, she's owner and chef of Monuts Donuts in Durham, and she's just leading the tip-free fight. This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Coldell Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. Jeff Tiberi is my co-host. I'm Leonita Inge.